Here we go. Hello, this is Bruce Baer. I'm a physician's assistant, wellness coach, and host of this teleseminar, which tonight we're calling Ask a Podiatrist Anything. Tonight's guest is Dr. Bruce Fawcett. Dr. Fawcett is a board-certified doctor of podiatric medicine, which means he operates on the lower leg, ankle, and foot. He hails from Raleigh, North Carolina, with offices in both Raleigh and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome, Dr. Fawcett.
Oh, Mr. Baer, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on our teleseminar. Before we start, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and experience, and about how if someone wanted to become a podiatrist, they would become one.
Well, I'd be glad to. Bruce, I've been practicing podiatry for 27 years, and as you mentioned, I live and work in Raleigh and in Chapel Hill. I'm married. I have three children. And we moved down here about 25 years ago, right when I was getting the career going from the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. There's 7 podiatry schools in the country, and I did a residency after my podiatry education was in Cleveland, and they're located in many of the major cities, New York, Chicago, L.A., Cleveland. And after my podiatry education, I did a residency in Pittsburgh, and then moved down here to Raleigh. I became interested in feet because I wanted a profession where there was a fair amount of responsibility, hands-on care with people, some independence in decision-making, good privileges and legal privileges in all the 50 states. And I wanted to have a job where not only was I helping people, but how should I say this? I didn't want the same kind of heavy responsibilities, say, that someone who has to treat cancer or those kind of issues. I also like the idea of being able to help people walk better, saving limbs, because that can be a real problem with the diabetic population. And in general, the work was interesting to me because I just wanted to do something with medicine, anatomy, and I enjoyed the educational experience itself. It's a 4-year program after college, after your undergraduate degree. The podiatry education is 4 additional years. And then residencies of 1, 2, or 3 years, where we learn our skills, of course, in the operating room and elsewhere.
Pretty extensive education.
Well, yes, sir. You learn your skills, and you learn what it's about. There's something about treating people. I know as a physician assistant, you appreciate this too, Bruce. There's something about that hands-on and treating people every day and getting to talk to different people every day. And there's so many different personalities out there, and it's a real joy to be able to help people and to also, after so many years of practice, to get to know several generations of people and their families. We help very young people with such problems as a flexible flat foot. We help middle-aged people who are trying to exercise and find they're having some overuse problems, say with their heel or arch. And we help older people who are maybe developing some arthritis or bursitis, because just like in other parts of the body, you can develop arthritic and swollen joints in the foot. So there's a pretty good spectrum of people to treat. And the limb salvage is of interest, too, helping diabetics better take care of their limbs, since that's such a major problem in our country. We're over 80,000 people a year, unfortunately, lose their toes, feet, or entire limbs to the devastating consequences of diabetes with its circulation and nervous system changes.
Based on the obesity epidemic, as they call it, podiatrists may be very, very busy in the future.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. We're one of the few creatures that God made that walk on 2 limbs rather than 4. We walk on a lot of hard, unforgiving surfaces, concrete and factory work. People such as a cashier that stands in one place all day, or some guy who works on a machine all day who doesn't move but 2 or 3 feet at a time. These are things that can really be hard on the foot. The foot's a remarkable piece of machinery. You know, it's not just like the hand, of course. It's specialized for its function. And it's been the subject of a problem since a man started writing and talking about himself, such things as Achilles' heel, Achilles' tendon, from Greek mythology. And so it has its place the foot certainly has its place in the overall human anatomy. And I would never propose that one part of the body is superior to another. Of course, the foot is at the lowest in terms of height, but it has its place, and anybody can tell you, an old cliche, when your foot's sore, you're sore all over. I guess you could say the same of the back and other places. But, yeah, when your foot's bothering you, it really put the brakes on. It really slow you down.
Well, you know, I put this website up for, a week or so now, and we've got, I just checked here, we've got a long list of questions from listeners. So I know that we've got some things that we wanted to get into, but let me run through these questions. Some of them they fall right in line with some of the things we were going to talk about anyway. So let me run through a few questions with you.
That sounds good.
All right, let's see. There's Catherine from Flat Rock, and she says, plantar fasciitis, what prevents it, and what is the treatment after it occurs?
It's a great question. I see it every day I practice. Plantar fasciitis, just to demystify the terminology itself, plantar just means the bottom of the foot. Like the palm of your hand is the underside of your hand, the plantar surface of your foot is the bottom of the foot. It's an anatomical term. It applies to anywhere. It means the bottom side of something, the plantar surface. And fasciitis, well, those words that have I-T-I-S on the end of them, itis, that's a generic term generally for inflammation. So you got the bottom of the foot is inflamed, and what is inflamed? It's the fascia. That's spelled F-A-S-C-I-A. The fascia is inflamed, and the fascia is a thick piece of ligament that runs from the ball of the foot all the way back to the heel. It's thick or wide, like a ribbon. It's much wider and thicker, say, than the tendons that you can visualize in the back of your own hand or the top of your foot, say. Well, this fascia is responsible for maintaining the arch when you stand on it. Now, everybody's arch flattens out some when they stand. That's natural, the force of your own body. And you have to be able to flatten your foot a little so that you can propel yourself in, as we describe it, a heel-to-toe propulsive gait. But if your foot flattens out too much, or if you're too heavy, or if getting back to, like if you stand in one place all day, like in a cashier or someone sorting mail, say, if you any of these things can just overburden that ligament that's a pretty thick, gristly-like piece of structure to the point where little tears occur in it. And when tears occur in that ligament, that would be the inflammation. So that plantar, bottom of the foot, fasciitis is an inflamed ligament. Most often seen on the heel, sometimes seen through the mid-arch portion of the foot. It would be very rare, Bruce, for the plantar fascia to completely rip or tear. You have little micro tears in it. But there is rare occasion when the whole ligament will tear, and that's very unusual. But this chronic, nagging, low-grade, recurrent micro-tears, they really take their toll after a while. And many people will experience an extreme sharp pain right about near the middle or the bottom of the heel when they first stand up after periods of rest, most typically described in the morning after they've been sleeping, but also seen after you've been, say, reading the paper or sitting at home. And then you stand up, and then it starts all over again. The peculiar thing about this plantar fasciitis is, for many people, that first step that it's so annoying, will last, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, and then slowly dissipate, and you don't feel it as much. There are some people, of course, that last all day, and they're of course much more liable to be in your office. Most people put up with these nagging little aches and pains for weeks to even months before they seek help about it. A couple of things that you can do for these micro tears are easily done at home, and they're certainly indicated even after you see a foot specialist. Generally, ice is very good for any acute inflammation, and some would argue even for chronic inflammation, but certainly for heel pain, ice can't be beat. There's all kinds of ways you can do ice, and I've heard everything and read everything and seen everything from putting your foot in a bucket of ice water, which almost sounds painful to me, but you know, there's something to be said for getting it cold and getting it done, rather than sort of dancing around the issue. So I kind of appreciate that approach. I've had heel pain twice, plantar fasciitis, and generally when you have it, it's very annoying, but when it goes away, it's almost always completely resolved. I can't remember which heel it is. I have to go back to my own chart on myself just to remind myself which heel it was. When you're going through it, like any pain, it's a real big nuisance. But once it's gone, it usually leaves you alone for long periods of time, or maybe recur months or years later, sometime depending on what you've been doing. Many people get plantar fasciitis, Bruce, if they're runners, say, or other types of exercise, or if they've been having a sedentary lifestyle and then they start to resume athletic pursuits at the advice of their doctor, or just decide it's time to start moving around in the spring or summer, we'll see a lot more heel pain as people sort of get out there and start pounding the pavement again. Other times, another cause that seem to be common to plantar fasciitis are, we see it a lot in the summer with the women who wear flip-flops, sandals, or shoes that just don't really hold the foot up at all. We'll hear about a typical case scenario would be somebody who would say, I had these flip-flops on and had no idea I'd be walking for hours on end, you know, and those kind of things. People such as teachers who have to wear pretty reasonable shoes during the year, and then in the summer just go barefoot or flip-flops or slippers, stocking feet, pumps, open-back shoes like clogs. Well, they're liable to get heel pain from this plantar fasciitis. Other causes are the foot structure itself. If a person is real pronated or real flat-footed, that ligament will become very pulled and more easily torn. So ice is very important, and you can't hardly overemphasize it. Ice in a Ziploc bag, ice in a bucket of water, a bag of peas to conform to the heel. Some people get a special boost if you got a water bottle and half fill it with water and freeze it. Then you can roll your foot over that and get more or less an ice massage and then refreeze that. That's a pretty good technique. I've heard of people freezing tennis balls and rubbing over there. Runners seem to especially like to use ice in a Dixie cup and that massage that right on there and then throw that away or refreeze it. They're all good things to do. Any of those ways that you can deliver ice. Or
how
help.
Long would you apply the ice for each time you applied it?
I would do, I think, 5 minutes twice a day would be the minimum. And, you know, the funny thing is, once people start getting better, they tend to not do these things. They'll do them for a while. And this is medicine in general. People tend to be compliant to a degree, and then compliance seems to fall off. But ice is always emphasized heavily in the treatment of plantar fasciitis. 5 minutes minimum twice a day, before or after activities is good. The other thing that's absolutely critical along with ice, the two other things I'll mention, is shoes and stretches. You just have to wear shoes with this problem to the point where if people tell me they just can't wear shoes or won't wear shoes in the house due to personal preference, more or less some ethnic people of certain ethnic backgrounds, it's just normal for them to go barefoot once they get in the house. These people have a much harder time getting over plantar fasciitis, I've found. And it's a real hard habit for them to get into, to wear shoes around their own home, or to it just is real hard for them to do. But it's important. Now, not all shoes are created equal. Boy, don't we know that. Especially with this plantar fasciitis, you're encouraged to get a shoe that has a firm heel counter. If you can think of a good quality name brand athletic shoe, there's many of them out there. Asics, Brooks, Saucony, Nike, New Balance too. They're all really good shoes if you buy a good one. You can buy certain name brand shoes that are not as expensive as their better models, and they're not as good as their better models. So a firm heel counter in an athletic style shoe or a walking style shoe is important, the heel counter being the part that loops around the back of the heel. The bottom of the shoe should have a nice thick crepe. I want to use the word crepe as a generic word, you know, a spongy kind of material, rubbery or spongy, a material with more or less a roll bar into the midfoot and the front of the foot. In other words, there's not that old, like, 90-degree cut in the bottom of the heel that leads to the midsole. You want that part to be rounded or filled in, let's say. Those kind of shoes, and then a firm heel counter, a deep heel seat, one that sits pretty deep on the heel, and laces up, and that's typically of a good athletic-style walking shoe, is going to be by far the best shoe you can wear for heel pain. There are exceptions to anything, but that's basically what you need to hold your foot up. So just to review briefly then, you want to use ice. You want to be shoed in a good shoe. Now, the lady or gentleman who feels that they have to wear shoes other than athletic shoes because of their employment, you can compromise a little, but you can't. You shouldn't do that at home. You should wear a real good shoe at home, like we're describing. For ladies in the marketplace, a pump often is much more comfortable for the heel pain than a flat shoe. A pump tends to accentuate that arch and sort of allow it not to flatten out. Topsiders and ladies' flat shoes are kind of hard on this problem. Penny loafers, tassel loafers, not as good as an athletic style or walking style tie, Oxford or athletic style shoe. So ice on your foot, good shoes really help plantar fasciitis. And stretches are universally prescribed by any authority who treats the foot for plantar fasciitis. Now, you want to be careful when with stretches. If you're in the real bad throes of this illness, where you're just extremely painful and every step is sheer agony, well, you don't want to stretch then. But once you start to get better, yeah, you want to do some general stretches. You can do your stretches non-weight bearing, which is good. It puts a little less load on that ligament. One of the typical stretches would be you want your, if you can just remember, toes towards your nose, whether you're weight-bearing or non-weight-bearing. When you stretch your toes towards your nose, you're stretching out the plantar fascia. And the idea behind stretches from the physiologists, physical therapists, and those who study such things indicate that when you stretch a ligament before you use it or after you use it, you make it stronger. You are able to use all the other ligament that's not having that micro tears. So in stretching a ligament before and after you use it, you allow the whole structure to become stronger in a sense. So toes towards your nose. The other things that can be done if you are not in acute pain with this plantar fasciitis, I know some runners, I would even call them elite runners, you know, 40-mile-a-week people, 50-mile-a-week runners, they stretch their Achilles and their plantar fascia by standing on a step and letting their heel come down using gravity. That would be an extreme stretch and only for people who are extremely fit. The other stretch for your ligament is where you lean into against the wall with your heel on the ground. I hope that you can visualize more or less what it would like, what it would look like doing a push-up against the wall. That's how that ligament can be stretched weight-bearing. And the one that seems to stretch it real good is where you actually grab the front of your foot with your hand and more or less pull your toes towards your nose, as I was describing. That specifically stretches the ligament. The Achilles tendon is stretched with these exercises as well, and it's a part, it is an important part of this component too. There's a whole host, whole litany of problems that occurs to in the Achilles tendon too. Maybe we can get to that, Bruce, but you don't, we don't see them in the same way as we do this plantar fasciitis. And at the risk of repeating myself ad nauseatum to anybody listening, stretches, ice, and good shoes. In my office, I write those three things on every handout I give people that has to do with plantar fasciitis.
Great. Now, plantar fasciitis would just be one cause of heel pain. Maybe heel spurs. Do they? I know that's a calcification of, the, of lots of times of that plantar fascia. Is that a kind of a complication of long-term fasciitis?
It can be. But Bruce, doggone it, that spur can be the proverbial red herring. It can make us all, and all concerned, patients and doctors alike, think, oh my goodness, look at that, I got a spur. Well, I have seen over 27 years intractable, what would seem insurmountable heel pain for some people that have no spur at all, and other people can have a heel spur visible on x-ray that's an incidental finding. That is to say, it just shows up while we're looking for something else. And you can talk to these people and say, my goodness, you have a large plantar heel spur. Did you know that? And they'll say, oh, no, my heels never hurt me. So the heel spur becomes a significant issue whenever it's shaped funny, if it has a point on it that's sticking right up into that ligament, if it's very large, yes, then the heel spur does become relevant. And I've had to resect, that is, remove plenty of those. Most heel pain can be treated without surgery. And once a person has tried stretches, ice, and good shoes, if they're running out of patience and hoping this thing will abate, which it usually will do according to what source you read, anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months. But if it's just getting too long and too tedious, and let's say you have an employment where you're on your feet all the time, or you have a real love of your sport and it's really interfering with your tennis or running, well, the other treatments, of course, physical therapy is always in fashion. Of course, they're going to tell you to do stretches and ice and use good shoes. But beyond that, they can sometimes really work those muscles and ligaments in a way that, you know, we just aren't self-disciplined enough to do ourselves. Other treatments for plantar fasciitis that are very commonly used are orthotics or over-the-counter intersoles. Orthotic being a term we use to distinguish, that is, a custom-made intersole made from a cast or an impression of the foot, holding the foot in a certain position that we think it functions around the best through processes of studies of biomechanics, which I won't bore you with the details, other than to say, yeah, if you think of the muscles and the bones being put together as a piece of machinery, of course they're going to function around certain planes in better fashions and certain axes in better fashions than they would in others. And if you have a foot structure that's real out of the mainstream, then you're probably somebody who an orthotic, custom-made orthotic, would really help. Sometimes over-the-counter intersoles can help too. And it's been my experience that the more rigid the over-the-counter intersole, probably the better the device will be, rather than a soft, flexible, something that you can just fold in your own hand. You must remember, if you're 160 to 260 pounds and you're coming down on something and you want it to do some good, it should have some oomph to it. It should have some substance and structure rather than just...
Brian, to that, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Rather than just be a flexible thing.
Are there brands that you recommend, or would just go in there and test their flexibility to decide whether?
I would be more prone to just say test the flexibility. Go towards something that's semi-rigid to rigid. Spenco's been around a good long time. They have both soft and rigid. Again, you get into the problem of name brands having different models, etc. So, but Spenco's good, and there's a whole host of other products that are just as good. To be blunt, I would stay away from the ones you can find just inexpensive in a drugstore, without mentioning any names, towards the ones that have a little bit more oomph to them. And just for the sake of completeness, other treatments for heel pain, you can have everything from walking cast, if it's very bad, night splints, cortisone injections, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines such as ibuprofen, naproxen. These are medicines that you see in Advil and Aleve. Orthotics, mentioned that. Shockwave therapy, which is a whole subject unto itself. We on occasion, if a person has plantar fasciitis that goes on for years and the body forgets to try and heal itself, we sometimes wake up that process by something called orthotripsy, which unfortunately has the terrible connotation of being called shockwave therapy, which sounds pretty scary but isn't. And that's nice because it's non-invasive and it does not involve a surgical incision. It's the same machine that breaks open kidney stones, breaks apart kidney stones. And that can be used to wake up the plantar fascia to start the process of healing again. There's times when surgery is in order, cutting that ligament or cutting that spur out. There's so many different treatments because not everybody responds to the same treatment. It's wonderful when people just get better with stretches, ice, and good shoes. But I would say that probably only happens maybe 50% of the time, Bruce. Otherwise, you got to start doing these other things.
So you start off with conservative management, and when that doesn't work, you move on to oral medicine, injectable medicine, PT, shockwave therapy, and as a last resort, then surgery.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned orthotics and intersoles. But, yeah, that is very, very good. Mm-hmm.
All right, so you covered several questions here because someone asked about shockwave therapy, so you've explained that. Someone else asked about intersoles. How do you find a good one? So you've explained that. We talked about heel pain and heel spurs. What about tarsal tunnel syndrome? Someone asked you, well, how common is it, what is it?
Oh, I'd be glad to talk about that, and maybe it'd be a good time too, Bruce, to talk a little bit about Achilles tendonitis.
Great.
Because they're all sort of back there. They're in the back of the foot. Tarsal tunnel syndrome, if you were, just so we're talking about the same side, if you can visualize, if you're standing there and you look down at your foot, on the inside border of your foot, on the inside border of the heel, there's a group of muscles, tendons at this point, tendons, nerves, and vessels, the course behind that bump that's on your ankle there on the inside border of your foot. And there's indeed a tunnel there. Many people have heard of carpal tunnel. That's in your wrist. The carpal bones are in your wrist. The tarsal bones are in your foot. And they're analogous in their location. They're kind of back away from the toes and fingers, if that makes sense. Anyway, the tarsal tunnel contains a few tendons, an artery, a vein, and the posterior tibial nerve. This posterior tibial nerve courses underneath the foot, doggone close to that plantar fascia inflammation site. And in some people, you can have both things going on. That's fairly rare. Or you can have the plantar fascia inflame in that posterior tibial nerve such that as a person gets over the plantar fascia inflammation itself, they'll say, I'm feeling a lot better, but I'm having a peculiar little sensation on the back or the side of my heel, or possibly further out into my toes. Sometimes we unmask a little inflammation of the posterior tibial nerve when we get the ligament feeling a little better. And since the two are fairly close, you can make the point or theory, some would, that nerve passes close enough to that ligament that maybe it's getting pinched and trapped, would be the word we would use. And when a person has posterior tibial nerve pain, that's called tarsal tunnel syndrome, the symptoms there would be pinpoint pain along that area where the nerve traverses and where it can get pinched in the tunnel, or nerve pain that shoots out to the toes, or back up the leg on the inside border of the leg. It, in and of itself, is a fairly rare phenomenon. We don't see it the same way we do plantar fasciitis. I would dare say we see it probably less than 1% of the time in terms of the heel pain. 99% of heel pain on the bottom of your heel, that's plantar fasciitis. 1% of the time is posterior tibial nerve entrapment. Now, you can have nerve conduction studies done if there's a high degree of suspicion of that nerve being pinched, because that's a very sensitive test, and it's specific. Generally, they can tell, you know, through these tests whether you have a nerve disease itself or a pinched nerve, and that's exactly what you want to find out if you think you are if you think you have tarsal tunnel syndrome. I've seen tarsal tunnel problems in people, Bruce, who have varicose veins back there. And that makes some sense, because everything's engorged, and there's only so much room going through there. And I've actually seen veins pulsatile back there, and people with pinched nerves shooting out their leg, up their leg or out their toes. Achilles tendon itself, if we can go on to that a minute.
Sure.
Achilles tendinopathy is a big term. It encompasses a lot of things. You can have a little bump on the back of your heel called a pump bump, named after the place where it would hit in a lady's shoe. A pump, if you can appreciate it. Before I mentioned a deep heel seat, a low heel seat will hit right on the Achilles tendon prominence called a Haglund's deformity, after the guy who wrote about it. Anyway, where that Achilles tendon inserts, there's an awful lot of tension and forces and things going on there. It's a busy area. That Achilles tendon can pull hard enough to form new bone prominence, actually a little bone spur there on the back of the heel. And as we mentioned before, the Achilles tendon, named after Achilles the warrior, who was almost invincible except for his Achilles heel. And it's the irony being, here was a man that was invincible, but his heel brought him down. So it does point up how long man has been fighting these little peculiar little problems and overuse problems. The Achilles tendon itself can rupture. You can have degrees of a rupture of an Achilles tendon. That's usually a little bit further back up the leg than right at the back of the heel. That's coming up a little bit, a couple inches up. Achilles tendon, a spontaneous Achilles tendon rupture is not a rare event in people who are just participating in sports. There's also other muscles and tendons that can have partial ruptures. Some of them rather big, like the posterior tibial tendon. Some of them very small, like gracilis. And when one of these little muscles or tendons rupture, typically a person will describe a feeling that, boy, I thought I got smacked in the back of my calf with a 2x4. Recently I heard a guy describe it. He looked around to see where the snake was that bit him. Well, there was no snake that bit him, and no one smacked a person in the back of the calf with a 2x4. It was just an acute tendon rupture can feel like that. They can be treated most of the time conservatively. Now with MRIs, showing how old I am, I remember when we didn't have MRIs, but now you can see just how bad a tendon rupture is, whereas years ago you really couldn't. But most tendon ruptures, like the plantar fascia tears, if they're not too bad, I'd say the vast majority can be treated conservatively with the cam walkers, that is, the removable casts with Velcro straps that you've seen, and immobilization. In some rare instances, we have to remove a posterior bump on the back of the calcaneus where the Achilles tendon inserts, and I've done plenty of that. again, it's a pretty rare thing to have to do. Most people treat pump bumps or posterior heel prominences with some of the things we mentioned for plantar fascia. Rest, ice, proper shoe wear, maybe a shoe with a little bit of a heel height to relax the Achilles tendon pull on that bump. Anti-inflammatories. Interestingly enough, you cannot give a cortisone shot to the back of the heel. You can certainly give one on the bottom, but you cannot give them on the back for fear of Achilles tendon rupture, which is truly something that is seen with cortisone injections to the back of the heel. So these other tarsal tunnel syndrome, pretty rare event, Achilles tendon and tendinopathy and pump bumps and tendon inflammation, fairly common problem. I think that covers the heel pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds like it does. Now, we've got two questions here about walking. One is from a woman by the name of Rosalie in Indianapolis, who I think Rosalie, if I know who she is, has a walking club. And she asks, for someone starting a walking program, what steps would you recommend so they have happy feet?
Well, it's a great, great question. And since I'm the podiatrist, the foot guy, I'll address that. But I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't say the things that we all know. You know, make sure you're healthy enough even to start a walking program. And that's where people like you, Bruce, and physicians and physician assistants, your family practitioners, they come into play to make sure that, you know, by God, you're healthy enough just to start out. A big problem with people who want to start walking is they don't have the proper shoe wear, and they don't train up as they would to any other sport in the world. I'll tell you a prime example of this. I know if you go half the people in the world, if you go look at the shoes they cut their grass with, which is when they, quite frankly, do most of their walking, they're the worst shoes, you know. They're the shoes that have been delegated to the pits, you know. They're one step away from being thrown out. But
and that's, they didn't have to cut the lawn, they had to put them in the garbage.
That's right. And, you know, when you think about it, that's not good, because that's when most people do their walking, even just around the house. But to start out, you want to make sure you have a good supportive shoe, much as we described earlier. That is, an athletic style or walking style shoe. The few dollars more you would spend in going to an athletic shoe store as opposed to your generic shoe store at the mall would probably be well spent. These people are sincere. I'm making my point to know all the athletic shoe people in my neighborhood. And these people are often walkers, runners themselves, and they really do know the story. And you might spend $10 or $20 more there than you would somewhere else, but they're going to get you in a shoe that's going to be proper for your foot. The last of the shoe, L-A-S-T of the shoe, is the shape that the shoe takes. Some of them have a straight last. Some of them have different forms to accommodate your foot structure. Most people's foot structure, if you think of those old bell-shaped curves, you know, most people's feet are not too flat and not too high arched. Most people have some combination of that. Ligaments hold our foot and muscles and bones. Ligaments hold our bones together, and some people's ligaments are tauter and tighter than others, and some are looser than others. And so you want a shoe that's going to accommodate your foot. If your foot flattens out a lot, you're going to want to have pronates a lot. That is, the arch falls flat on the ground when you stand there. Everybody off weight bearing has an arch, incidentally, and only those with extreme flat foot don't. But if when you stand up you lose your arch a whole lot, well, then you pronate, and then you'll want a shoe that holds your foot up a bit so you're not pronating as much. The pronation, everybody has to pronate. That's how you get your foot down, and a heel-to-toe propulsive gait, you have to pronate some to get that first toe down to propel yourself. Pronation in and of itself is a normal part of walking. It's the overpronation that can be a problem with such things as heel pain and the development of hammer toes and bunions and things like that. So good shoes, frequently changing your shoes, a good name brand. New Balance shoes come in widths, which is a nice feature. you would think that was a unique, I mean, you know, it seems obvious that shoes should come in widths, but a lot of athletic shoes really don't. Or they have a minimum degree of widths, but New Balance do have actual widths and a wider variety of widths. The material shoe is made of anymore with the composite materials are fine. They breathe a little bit, and that'll help with the airing out the foot, trying to prevent foot fungus and hyperperspiration down there. And those materials hold up well. And most athletic shoes are a combination of synthetic materials, rubber, leather, things of that nature. And you want to, in general, you want to have a shoe that when you hold it in your hand and you push up on the front of it, it just doesn't fold in half. And there should be some rigidity there. It should give a little, but it shouldn't just fold in half. And the heel counter needs to be firm, and several eyelets. You know, most any good athletic shoe is going to have 6, 7, 8 eyelets, and that's kind of what you need. Incidentally, if you have a bump on the top of your foot, like a ganglion, sometimes you can skip a lace over type of those little bumps. The best thing I can tell you about shoes is to replace them often. Most people use them way past their prime. So if you're starting an exercise club, walking club, you just start out easy, and you don't forget that just like any athlete, you have to train up. The surfaces you walk on do have some bearing on how much jarring and how much pressure your foot get. It's always better to walk on anything except asphalt, linoleum, or concrete, but unfortunately in the world in which we live, that's where most people have to walk. A track is nice, but it's a rare luxury. And the thing that's so wonderful about walking is it can be done at any age, at any time, I guess if it's not raining, and you can do it right out in your own backyard. You just start right out your door, and that's so much nicer than it's easier to do. Compliance will be higher, and it's really good for your heart and lungs. So just go slow, replace your shoes frequently, do some stretches before you go, do some stretches after you come back, and take time to build up your distance. Those are the main things. Anything else you can think to add to that, Bruce?
No, I try to tell people that when they walk, they should hold their tummy in and tighten up their core because it takes some of the pressure off the knees and feet. They don't hammer them down so hard if they stand up and tighten up their core a little bit.
That's great advice.
Like punching.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Pick up your feet, and that's right. Have good posture.
We've got two questions about infections. Glenn from Monroe says, is discomfort the only problem with warts, and how are they commonly treated?
Boy, that's a great question. Warts are a scourge. They've been around a long time, too. Warts are caused by a virus, the human papilloma virus. Plantar warts, again, are warts on the bottom of the foot. But warts you get on your hands and feet or your knees or your skin, these warts are very, very recalcitrant. That is, very tough to treat. In some instances, people carry them all their life. And, boy, that's a frustrating thing. They can be anywhere from the size of a match head to a real large patch I've seen in some people as big as, oh, really, a couple silver dollars side by side, if you can visualize such a thing. We don't know why some people are more prone to warts than others or more prone to viruses. Why do some people get more colds than others? That kind of thing. And the virus lifestyle, the virus life cycle is a hard thing to study, so we don't have a good handle on it. One of the things about warts invading the skin, though, there's 5 layers to the skin. I won't bore you with those technical histologic names. But the wart gets in there just deep enough to become a real irritant, make it feel like you're walking on a stone, but maybe not quite deep enough to stimulate your own immune system to the idea that it's being invaded. And so our own immunity seems to fail us. Our skin is doing almost too good of a job of being a barrier. And it's until the skin wakes up, the deep blood vessels and the immune system, the daggone work can thrive and just hang out. Now, warts, I'm always asked, are warts contagious? Well, in the strictest sense of the term, contagious is, yes, they are, but it's a pretty strong term for it. I mean, you have to have a certain susceptibility to warts to pick them up in almost every instance. And there does seem to be some immunity granted to people after they've been exposed to them. For instance, warts seems to be a young people's or teenagers' disease by and large, with some exception. But we see it in that population of people. Grade schoolers, middle schoolers, high schoolers, and college kids seem to get these warts. And after they, so many weeks or months, and they slough them off, either with treatment or without, they seem to eventually resolve. And then they probably won't ever get a wart again in, on their foot or hands, or maybe only very rarely. So the treatment for warts can be very problematic, depending on what age group you're treating. You just hate it in young kids because they're so scared of you to begin with, and they're ugly, and they don't like them, and the treatment can be a little tender. The treatment for warts is very long. There's very numerous ways to treat it because nothing ever works all that great. They can be trimmed. They can be trimmed by the patient with a pumice stone or an abrasive sandpaper. They can be trimmed by the doctor with a scalpel. Topical acids are used to try and get the wart to slough off of the skin. Freezings of various types, either over the counter, you can buy these now, or at your podiatrist or dermatologist and family practitioner, we can freeze these warts to try to make them slough off. A combination of acids and freezings. In some instances, they actually curette them out. Curetting meaning scoop them out with a small spoon-like device. Whenever an adult has an isolated wart, they generally respond very good to curetting or spooning them out. When a person of any age has what we call mosaic warts, that is, a few warts here, a few warts over here, an inch away, a few more warts half an inch away over here, some running together and some separated by large patches of normal skin, those mosaic wart patterns, oh, they're very hard to treat, very frustrating. The good thing to keep in mind about warts is most people, you just get rid of them. You just eventually get immunity and slough them. They slough off. In the meantime, if a person has warts and they're worried about spreading them to their family members, use of Crocs or flip-flops around the pool, in motels, even in your own house if you're worried about spreading them through the shower, are indicated. And yeah, that's probably a good idea if the warts are really a problem. I know I have one family who I know that has six girls. That's a big family, a big undertaking. The mother is, I'm just going to say our age, she's in her 50s, and every one of her girls has warts, and she has warts, and they've just been a scourge to that family. And all the treatments, and even some of the more experimental treatments, bleomycin injections and other things like that, just haven't worked for this family. Interestingly enough, there seems to be some incidental correlation between the use of Tagamet and the sloughing of warts, which is something I cannot explain, and I don't know that I can condone it. But the doggone truth is, whenever you're facing one of these nasty little illnesses and you've been through 8 or 10 conventional methodical treatments that have been around forever and you still have it, you start looking for alternatives, I know. But that's what I can tell you about warts in a few minutes.
That's great. Now, we have a question about something just as equally difficult to treat, and that's toe fungus. They want to know, and I'm assuming they're meaning toenail fungus.
Yeah.
What's the best and natural, if possible, way of getting rid of toe fungus?
Oh, brother, that's a great question. Well, doggone it, I know they asked for a natural thing right there, and you're asking for a natural kind of thing, but there's not a great natural treatment for toe fungus, toenail fungus that I know. I do, being trained as I was in cause and effect kind of medicine, Bruce, and I know you know what I mean here, I look at studies and I look at scientific data. By and large, the best scientific data we have for a proven treatment is the use of terbinafine, previously the trade name Lamisil. A 3-month course, one a day, seems to cure about 89% of people with toenail fungus. The trouble with any treatment of fungus, whether it be scientific or some of these homeopathic things such as tea tree oil or vinegar soaks, Clorox soaks, Vicks Vapo rub, those are all the things. And I don't really condone them, and I don't recommend them, but since I'm here to share information, I've heard of all them being used. Well, the treatment some of those, like Vicks and other things, just make the nails slough off due to the chemicals in there, and the idea then being you'll get a new nail to grow. Some of the mildest cases of toenail fungus, one or two nails, with just a white, stucky, flaky, stuck-on appearance fungus. They respond to topical agents that you can buy in a drugstore that have been around forever, for everything from athlete's foot to jock itch. But you want to make sure it's antifungal. Now, if you start getting 8 or 10 toenails that are very thick, funny-looking, funny-growing, mildly odorous, don't smell good, have lost their luster, that's the way we describe it, you know, have lost their normal shine, and have taken on a brown to yellow to blackened appearance, why, any topical medicine is just not going to work good for 8 or 10 nails like that. A couple other things. Most people's fifth toenails are funny, peculiar, dystrophic would be the word, meaning they don't grow normal. It's almost like your body ran out of juice, of energy, to take care of something that far away from its body core. And many people's fifth toenail plates are not of a normal luster, shine, appearance, color. And we try to get people not to worry too much about something like their fifth toenail plate. You know, you'd be surprised how many people are concerned about the appearance of their first toenail plates. And I don't blame them. You know, I don't want to look any older than I am, and I don't want to. I don't need anything to do to distract from my appearance. So it's interesting. Sometimes something like this can really interfere with the patient's interactions with their loved ones. They don't like sharing space with people who have that. But I don't have good answers for homeopathic or. Those kind of treatments, topical treatments, don't seem to work as well. So oral Lamisil, and then, doggone it, fungus and athlete's foot fungus, no matter where it occurs, from anywhere on your person, doggone it, is very recurrent, chronic kind of problem that some people just fight more than others. People who have a lot of hyperhidrosis or sweat a lot, they're going to have more athlete's foot. People who an athlete's foot then eventually turns into athlete's foot nails, as we're describing them. People who work in chemicals have to wear steel-toed shoes in certain industries, say where there'd be a lot of oils or chemicals, and they're going to keep re-exposing their foot to the fungus that's already inside of their shoe. So you can really take this to extremes, but air and sun are the most natural enemies against athlete's foot fungus. Those people who can let their toes expose to the air You know, don't have to wear clothes and shoes in the summer in particular. That's probably pretty good. And I do use topical antifungals for mild cases of fungus nail disease. But it's pretty hard once you have 8 or 10 nails that are extremely affected to think that any topical medicine in the world is going to work on that.
Okay, so basically if you've got skin fungus, then you probably can use over-the-counter stuff. But if you have significant nail fungus, then you need some help from your doctor, your local podiatrist.
I couldn't have said that better. That's exactly the truth. And the over-the-counter antifungals that are for sale at a drugstore, Lamisil, Lotrimin, they're fine products. They've been around a while. You want to be careful in buying things. You know, be careful that you are indeed. And this is where your pharmacist comes in. Just say, I would need a good antifungal. You know, because some people think that antifungal is an anti-itch or an anti-this. But if you got a fungus, you need an antifungal. And that's not Neosporin, for instance. Neosporin is a, you know, fights bacteria. So it's this is where you want to ask your doctor, your physician's assistant, your pharmacist, specifically for what you need. There's different types of fungus that affect the skin. Most people think of fungus, Bruce, of their skin as those weeping, moist lesions in between the toes and blistering kind of lesions. And that's very real and very true. But there's also fungus that can make your foot thick, hard, dry, and calloused in appearance. And that's a more chronic type of athlete's foot fungus. And in order for topical agents to work on that, well, sometimes you have to have first use an agent to debride or eat away at all that hard, callous tissue. And so it can get a little, what seems like a simple thing, it can get a little complicated.
All right. Those are good answers. Now, we have two other questions, and they kind of blend into what we had originally planned ourselves before we had discovered all these questions.
Yeah.
One fella asks us, let's see, Glenn, again, asks, what's a hammer toe?
A hammer toe is simply stated, a bent digit. Your toes, when you stand up, most of them should be lying there pretty straight as you look down at them. Sometimes one might be a little more bent than another, and it can be bent in various planes. It can be bent up and down. It can be bent left or right. And a hammer toe digit is a digit that's bent. It's usually described as the lesser, that is, digits 2, 3, 4, or 5. You can have a first toe hammer toe digit, but it's a little more rare. That might be seen in certain neurologic diseases more so. Hammer toes come on with age, just like people's hands get a little gnarly with age, and other joints get a little bent. It'd be very rare to see hammer toes, say, in a teenager. And with each succeeding decade, you'll see more and more prevalence of it. Hammer toes are an imbalance of the, strictly speaking, scientifically speaking, there's very little tiny muscles and tendons that insert on our toes that help maintain their straightness. These are so-called intrinsic muscles and tendons. They originate and insert within the confines of the foot itself. And then there's long muscles and tendons originating up higher in your leg that come down, cross your ankle, insert on your toes. All these muscles, tendons, and ligaments work in concert to try and keep your toes straight and through the walking cycle. When certain ones become overpowered due to foot structure or time or weakness, which occurs, then certain of these tendons overbalance the others and the toe becomes bent. Hammer toes can be accommodated in their mildest form through shoes with a deep and wide toe box. They can be taped and strapped down in extreme cases. Second toe hammer toes are pretty common. If a person has a bunion or a first toe deformity, the second toe kind of gets out of the way of the first toe. And then besides bigger shoe boxes and toes, orthotics and tapings and strappings, in some instances, yeah, you have to have surgery to straighten out the toe. If it's real bent and you're getting corns on them, that'd be the the kind of the old-fashioned term for hard skin lesions that form on top, or irritated joints that form because of the hammer toe. It's a pretty common entity. Nobody's toes are perfectly straight. There's no textbook foot, but you see more hammer toes in people as they age because of, say, arthritis, let's say.
Okay, so would stretching exercises and things like that be beneficial to help prevent hammer toes?
For some people, I would say that'd be true. And for others, I hate to be such a wishy-washy answer, Bruce. For some people, that's true. If you keep your muscles, tendons, and ligaments in good shape, you're going to be less prone to that. And some people who do like yoga and things like that, it's going to be they're not going to be bothered as much. But once a hammer toe goes from a flexible to a rigid state, all the stretching in the world probably won't help it very much. And it's interesting. Some people seem to be able to tolerate hammer toes or bunions and bumps and lumps of their feet a lot easier than others. Some folks, the slightest little bend in there can really cause them undue pain and undue calloration and inflammation and irritation of the skin. I certainly advocate a very conservative approach that the only things that should be surgically corrected are those that are just killing you. If you can function and do your work and recreation and don't find that you're popping a bunch of Advil every night for bent toes, well, then you kind of just live with that, you know?
Okay. Now, let's wind up with a very, very important topic and one that we kind of started off with, and that's the diabetic foot. How about reviewing maybe some basic guidelines for diabetic patients on, you know, do's and don'ts for your feet? You know, I know that my mother's got diabetes, and she sees a podiatrist, and his big no-no is she's not allowed to trim her toenails or corns or calluses. He says, leave your feet alone.
Yeah.
What other stuff can you impart here to our listeners?
Well, yeah, and boy, it's a big part of any podiatrist's life and a big part of mine. I unfortunately right now have a diabetic patient in the hospital who, unfortunately we had to, this patient, just to give you the case scenario, you can start with a callus, and this person had a callus underneath their first metatarsal head behind the first toe on the bottom of the foot. Due to biomechanic abnormalities that occurred over time, and then nerve changes, they didn't feel their foot. And diabetics can tell you, some do and some don't, but the nervous system that relays messages to our brain goes haywire in some diabetics, such that they don't feel things. And, for instance, they can become numb. And then it affects the muscles themselves, and the innervation of the muscles becomes screwy, such that your toes become bent. Well, these people can develop calluses they don't feel. A callus that you don't feel long enough, or a blister that you don't feel long enough, becomes hot, red, inflamed. Well, that can become infected. And then the numbness can be so profound that they don't even feel that. Now, if you combine that with some degree of circulation impairment, which is a nice way of describing peripheral vascular disease, which is a nice way of describing, you know, their arteries just aren't supplying enough blood to their extremities anymore. If you combine that with nerve disorder, and a callus can become an ulcer, can become an abscess, can become an infection, and now you have a real scenario for a very hard situation to heal. Well, my poor diabetic is in the hospital now. What we had to do was we had to get a stent placed in their extremity, the vascular surgeon, and they couldn't do this years ago. Got new blood going down there through a minimally invasive kind of procedure. And then that enabled us to know that whatever we have to do to the foot to get it to heal should heal. There's now enough blood getting down there. Well, unfortunately, the infection had gone to the bone, which had shown up on an MRI, and we knew, and we now know, that you're not going to heal a bone that's infected. You have to more or less resect that, which is, You know, a nice word of saying you have to remove that, which is a nice way of saying you got to amputate part of the foot. This is why 80,000 diabetics a year in our country lose part of their toe or feet. And as gruesome and as terrible as that sounds, and it is, a lot of it could be prevented if you would trim a callus before it becomes an ulcer. Treat an ulcer before it becomes an abscess. Treat an abscess, for God's sake, before it becomes a bone infection. And any step along that line, you know, can save a limb. Once a person loses an entire limb, the statistics are fairly grim for their longevity. That is to say, many of those people, you know, don't live a long, full, productive life once you start losing limbs. It's bad enough to lose part of your toe or foot, and that's bad enough, but it's better than losing a limb. A lot of diabetic foot problems could be prevented by simply, yes, having someone look at their own foot every day. If they can't see their own foot due to their size or their vision, then have a loved one actually have to inspect their foot. If not every day, then certainly once a week. Look for problems in between the toes. Look for calluses, ulcers, and blisters, ingrown, infected nails. Since diabetics, I hate to stereotype people, but if some type 2, that is, heavy diabetics, can't get to their own feet, don't have the right instruments, they start hacking up their own feet when they trim their nails, Bruce, or pick at a callus or a corn, and then before you know it, now you have the recipe for what we just described a minute ago as one problem leading to another. What starts out as simple, what sounds as simple as an ingrown nail or a simple callus can lead to the cascade of events of loss of limb. And that's a pitiful thing, and we hate that. Part of podiatrist work is indeed just making sure the everyday mundane nail and skin of the foot of a diabetic or other elderly person with peripheral vascular disease is not going to be the source of them losing their foot or their leg. So you look at your own feet, you be real conservative and sensible with footwear if you're a diabetic. Make sure that someone is looking at your foot on your exams. Doesn't necessarily have to be a podiatrist, but often it is because your other practitioners are so concerned with everything else going on. Everybody has a job to do, but if you want your feet looked at if you're a diabetic by your healthcare practitioner or podiatrist.
All right. I think that kind of winds up our time here, Dr. Fawcett. We really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk and explain these things to us.
Well, Bruce, it's a pleasure. It went much quicker, and I was worried about how I was going to fill in the time, but you're really good at drawing out these questions, and I hope I wasn't too long-winded on these answers.
You did great. We really appreciate it. We'd love to have you back again sometime.
It'd be my pleasure, Bruce.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for the questions that you've typed in here on the webcast and for everybody listening on the call. We thank you very much. We hope that you find this informative. This will remain posted where it can be downloaded. I'll add a link on my blog, and Dr. Fawcett will put one on his website. And we will hope to have him back again soon.
Thank you very much, Bruce. I hope you have a good evening.
All right, you too, and until next time, we're going to wish you all well. We're going to play a little piece of music here, and we're out of here. So everyone have a good night.
Night.
Good night.